Hello, and welcome to the Essential Conversations podcast series, a podcast for behavioral health providers in Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, and Nebraska. Each person who enters recovery is as unique as the story that they bring with them. And this month, in honor of Recovery Month, we will be bringing you recovery stories from people in diverse populations. Hear what people in these communities want providers to know. I hope you enjoy.
Good morning. We are here to talk about essential conversations with people who belong to diverse communities. I am Darla Bellflower, a person in long-term recovery. And for Recovery Month, I will be doing several interviews with people from diverse backgrounds. And today, my guest is Lisa. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for agreeing to the interview. So, Lisa, I have known you for some time, and I know that you are a person in recovery. How would you describe that for yourself?
An absolute gift and a privilege and a miracle.
Very nice. Very nice. And for your recovery, is that something that is abstinence everything or abstinence one particular substance, or what does that look like for you?
So I got sober as a young person, which some people might call the olden days, and definitely come from and still adhere to an abstinence-based model, like to the point of where I don't do mouthwash that has alcohol in it. I don't do food in restaurants if I see that there's alcohol in the sauce. I actively avoid any kind of exposure whatsoever. And that's partially, I think, just how I was schooled in terms of how I got sober. And I think that's partially just because, I don't know if I want to use the word respect, but the awareness that I have of my brain and my disease, and that I don't want to give it any little bit of anything, be it through a dessert or a mouthwash or whatever, that allows it to remember, like, oh, this is the thing that I did. Sometimes I think about this analogy, and I'm sure I am not the one who made this up. My addiction is like a tiger or a dragon, and it's sleeping if I feed it with things like prayer, abstinence, meetings, connection with other people. And it starts to get pacey and it wakes up, you know, if I'm exposed to a substance or a conflict or, you know, I'm not really, you know, I'm having good emotional sobriety or, you know, whatever the thing is. And so I try and keep that dragon or tiger asleep. For me personally, that's just part of what works, is total abstinence up until and including all of those other things I mentioned.
And you said that you got sober as a young person. You were under the age of 21, correct?
So I was a few months short of my 16th birthday. So I was actually 15 when I got sober.
Congratulations for maintaining that since the olden days, as you said. I know a lot of people refer to people who get sober before the age of 21 as minor miracles, and I absolutely believe that. So congratulations on that. Can you tell me a little bit about your labels or how you identify? What does that look like for you?
So I identify in a lot of different ways. I mean, I identify as an addict and alcoholic. I identify as a single mom. I identify as a queer and lesbian mom. And I also identify in terms of a variety of faith-based spectrums. There's a lot of different religions that I practice. And my family happens to be made up through international adoption. So I also identify in that sense that I'm part of a multiracial family. I am the minority in my family because A, I have two children and just one me mom. And then B, my children are both from Africa and different parts of Africa. So our family is conspicuous. And, you know, those other factors about me that incorporate my own otherness, I think add to, I can use the word conspicuous. I can use the word special. I mean, you know, it kind of just like depends on the lens I want to use or the setting that we're in. But, you know, we have our own barriers and just our own identity as a family. I think that just has some unique aspects.
I get that. I too Well, I start to say was. I still am a lesbian mom, and my daughter's grown now. So I know what my experience was like whenever my daughter was growing up in the 90s and early 2000s, and, you know, dealing with the school or daycare or church or other personnel. What has that been like for you with your daughters?
So I think that it has varied, you know, throughout the years. There was a time in my life when I was married, and the people showing up to my oldest daughter's school events were myself, my ex-wife, and then my heterosexual male best friend who acted and does act as a father to my oldest daughter. So I think initially people thought it was like a plural marriage sitch, or I'm not really sure what that looked like, you know. And finally someone, and we also, you know, my daughter went to a very like middle upper class, you know, like pretty bougie kind of area. And we just definitely stuck out. And finally, one of the brave moms just came up to me and was like, kind of like, what's the deal, basically? And I was like, here's the deal. So I'm gay, and this is my wife, and this is my daughter's father. And I mean, not biological, but, you know, like through adoption. And so I think that it's taken a lot of opportunities to educate. And then as a single mom now, I've been divorced for a number of years, and I'm raising my youngest daughter myself completely. There are also a lot of nuances into that because, like we were talking about before, I think that I can be straight presenting. And I am sensitive to that because I'm sensitive to having straight privilege. And I'm sensitive to the fact that there are people in my community that are targeted every day because they are identifiably gay and because of how they look. And any way that I can share the burden of that, I want to. So there are times it's frustrating for me that people assume I'm straight. And I think the fact as well that I'm single, you know, it's not an obvious clue because I'm not introducing you to my wife or my girlfriend that you are not going to know that I'm gay unless I tell you. That being said, I'm extremely out in the school setting and in all settings. I think it's important for my daughter's teachers to know what her family looks like and is like. And also, I've just been an out person for a number of years anyway. And so, I mean, for me, it looks a lot like, you know, when the teachers say, tell me about your family or tell me about your child. It's like, okay, so here's all these pieces of information about my daughter. And then in addition to that, she's being raised by a single mom. In addition to that, she's being raised by a queer mom. In addition to that, she has a lot of different faiths that we practice. She might talk about a lot of different religious celebrations that we do or miss school for certain things or whatever, whatever. It's an opportunity for me to educate a lot. And I think as a single mom, sometimes it feels like it lacks a little bit of legitimacy. Like,
what lacks a little bit of legitimacy? Your queerness?
Yes. Like, I feel like it made more sense in the context of this is my wife. People got that. Mm-hmm. They got that I had a wedding ring. They got that I had a person who showed up to events. They got that I had a person that, you know, went to, you know, my daughter's games or whatever the thing was. I feel like in general, there's probably a little more legitimacy for just parents in general that are part of a unit, not just one. Mm-hmm. And then I feel like in general too, because of maybe just people's discomfort with our community, that I don't know, it just seems like everyone feels a little cozier when you're partnered. Right. And so not being partnered feels a little bit like I'm just flying solo. And then there's this other thing about me too, you know, that I'm gay, that I think it just feels like people got it more.
Right.
Maybe it fit the norm more. I think like single gay people maybe don't fit the norm as well and broader culture as partnered gay people. You know what I mean?
I do. And people don't question heterosexual folks if they're not partnered up. It's just assumed, right? That's always the assumption, especially if you're, you know, straight passing. Lisa, did you ever go to formal treatment whenever you were young?
I did. So I initially got sober with a group called Crossroads, which is, in certain parts of the world. And so I was raised in St. Louis, where Crossroads is pretty prevalent. So I did go to 4 treatment centers, and they were all, I think they were all Crossroads affiliated. And because it was, I'm going to say the olden days, you know, because it was a long time ago and that was a different world for treatment, I was on treatment for almost a year because that's when treatment could last for months and months and insurance was approving people to be in treatment for long term. And so most of my 15th year was spent in treatment centers.
And were you out at that time?
At that time, I was out as bisexual, which I no longer identify as. And I really feel like, so this is, if there's anything that's like pivotal about my coming out story and my addiction and how they intersect, I think it is that. I feel really confident that if I had not developed an addiction, I would have stayed kind of gold star lesbian. And, you know, the thing that really took that part of my identity from me was my drug and alcohol addiction. There were a lot of men in my life at that time. I started using at 11 years old. So I definitely needed to make connections with other people so I could access alcohol, because clearly I wasn't going to get served or things like that as a young person. And so those connections for me wound up being with men and older guys. And so I did wind up having a lot of relationships with those people, thinking, you know, maybe they, I mean, I don't know what I thought they were based on, right? Because I was like a fucked up, you know, addicted kid. But I know that when I was getting sober, I knew that I liked women. And I knew that I had had a lot of, you know, sexual activity with men. So I identified that as bisexual. And it wasn't until I had been sober for some years that I was really able to come home to the truth, which is that I'm gay. And I was thrown off course in that part of my life's development, you know, because I was hanging out with people that could get me drugs and alcohol. And that it took me some time in sobriety to shed that. For me, that was really essential and really liberating. I was in my early 20s when I really came home to the fact that I'm queer and I'm not ever dating a man again. That was a beautiful and important moment for me.
And you used the term gold star lesbian, and I promise you that a lot of our listeners are not going to know what that is. So do you want to tell them what that is? Because that's kind of important as well.
Yeah. So gold star lesbian, to my understanding, is a lesbian who's never had sex with men. So I call myself a born again gold star. So I'm a born again.
That's wonderful. I love that.
I'm a born again Christian and a born again gold star lesbian. So, you know, but yeah, like for me, like my relationships with men, in terms of like my sexual relationships with men, they were so tied into that part of my life. So tied into my trauma, to my addiction, that once that part of my soul had settled down, that was no longer the direction I went at all.
Being a young person in recovery, what did you do after treatment? Did you attend 12-step meetings? Was there specialized young people's meetings or activities? Like what kept you in recovery?
Well, I want to say God. And whatever word that is comfortable for listeners, right? And I have a lot of words for that as well, but God, period. And then, so when I got out of treatment, I actually started using again, because, you know, that is what we do. And that is what I did. So when I got busted again, there was a big meeting. At that time, I was at a private school for teenagers that had drug and alcohol problems in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. So it was a very sheltered environment. They did drops on us weekly. We had group counseling. We had individual counseling. We had AA meetings on site. Most of the people there were trying to get sober or had been put there because of drug and alcohol issues. So at that time.
So what year was that?
Oh, 1989 is when I got sober. So I started doing 90 meetings in 90 days again. That was like kind of one of the punishments or whatever, you know, like, if I don't get it this time, you know, my parents, of course, understandably, were like, dude, we've done all these treatment centers. And I was all around the United States for them, mostly out of state. And then I come home and I start using again. So everyone was in despair, including myself. And I was asked, well, I was told to do 90 and 90 again. I had already done 90 and 90 through AA. At that point, I was mostly doing AA, not Crossroads. And I went to a meeting that changed my life. I feel like any meeting I go to could have changed my life. And that particular meeting, I didn't drink after that meeting. And then I went back the next day. And then I didn't drink after that meeting. And then I went back the next day. And I feel like that decision was made for me by my higher power in a way that had been trying to be made for a long time. and I wasn't ready to listen, or I wasn't ready to submit, or however you want to look at it. But I definitely feel like it was a decision made for me by my angels and by my God, and I took the gift.
What do you think was that magic formula, if you will, that helped with that connectivity that day? I know that you said that it was a God thing and that it was your higher power, but was there a person or a speaker or something that was said? Can you remember?
Sure. Yeah. So this gets into a little bit of trauma, which is that okay if I mention that?
Sure. Okay. You know, respectfully.
So up until that time, clearly, you know, as a young person using, I had a lot of trauma, you know, pre-using and that I had accrued during my using. And so I showed up at this meeting and it was full of, frankly, it was full of old white men. And I walked into a room of men that looked like my grandfather. And I didn't feel safe, because I didn't feel safe in rooms of men at that time in my life. And I was wondering, how is this going to go? I was expecting there to be more women. I was the only girl. And, you know, they all treated me like a granddaughter. They took me under their wing. They showed me their big books. They highlighted things in my big book. They gave me these little cards, you know, like with the promises. You know, they gave me all of our, you know, the literature, all of the things. And for me, as a survivor and as a young person who had not felt safe in the company of men and groups of men, the fact that this group of men took me under their wing and treated me like the child that I was in a loving, kind way, I feel like was probably a miracle. For me.
That is amazing and not what I expected you to say. What a beautiful gift that you were given. Yeah, that's incredible. So you have been in recovery for 30, how long? Long time.
So I celebrated 34 years this past July through the grace of God.
34. Yes. I knew that it was that you were in your 30s. That, I mean, you know, your recovery count, so to speak. So in those years, a lot has changed, right? About attitudes towards recovery and, you know, what it was like being a young person. And, you know, I was a young person in recovery as well and came to recovery prior to the age of 21. And so I know for me, there was a lot of times where people would, you know, oh, there's no way that you could be someone who is addicted to substances. Only, you know, there's no way you could be a drunk or an addict, right? Yes. So there was a lot of that, which then caused self-doubt, which was one attitude whenever I was young, all the way up to you can't be somebody who has a drinking problem because you've never lost your house, you've never lost your family, you don't drink under a bridge, like all the things, right? So what has the assumptions and stigmas looked like for you, and how have you navigated that?
So I totally get what you're saying. I mean, I think even among recovery circles where I am well known, when I pick up my chip, at least one person will say, like, what were you, 5 when you got sober? And the implication in that is maybe I don't really belong there. Maybe I'm not really an addict, an alcoholic. I know when I was first trying to get sober, I remember I went to a doctor's appointment and I told him I was in recovery. And he was like, you're 15 or 16, or however, I was 15 or 16, and really kind of trying to talk me out of it. And so probably like you, I had opportunities, if I had wanted to say, you know, maybe I'll go back out because maybe it's not real. Maybe this thing isn't really real. And A, that's crazy. B, that's other people's assumptions, not mine. And C, I think a lot of ways I've navigated that is just, I can feel really close to the parts of myself that were active in addiction and what that looked like. And how that almost killed me. And it didn't matter how young I was. And it didn't matter what kind of family background I had. None of it mattered. I mean, what mattered for me is that as soon as I took my first drink and I got high for the first time, my life no longer belonged to me. It belonged to drugs and alcohol, and it belonged to the people who had drugs and alcohol. And for me, that looked very dangerous. For me, I lived the life of a trafficked individual at a young age. And so I have that experience as well. And so living out of that and coming out of that, I'm very clear about who I am today and where I come from. What other people think or don't think about, like, how could you be that young and what was it really like when you were that young? I mean, if you hear me speak at the podium, you know. And if you don't, it's not your business. It's my business. It's my God's business. And I'm very clear about that. And I have a lot of peace around that. And I don't feel like I need to defend my status to anyone.
Good for you. What is it that you would want professionals, people who serve or work with people who have substance use disorder, what is it that you would want them to know about you, your community, the people that they serve who might have similar backgrounds to you or parts of or pieces of your background? What is it you would like them to know?
I mean, I think one thing that a lot of providers kind of know, but is helpful to know, is that part of how the queer community often congregates is around drug and alcohol-based activity. Uh-huh. So if you are a sober person and you're also a gay person,
right,
that is a conflict, or it can be a conflict. And that's good to know. I think when working with our community is that there is that piece. And as a marginalized community as well, there's higher rates of addiction. And so there's that piece. And some of those other things, like I spoke about in terms of my history, around it just not being safe for women in a world that's dominated by men, the world, you know, the using world, that to have extra sensitivity around that, around what it looks like for a female who's getting sober, may have some nuances around. And I'm going to use the words female and male, even though I'm absolutely supportive and embracing of all gender identity. So I don't mean to be narrow in that scope, but just to say that anyone who is female or female identifying who is trying to get clean has very likely had experiences that are scary, that are unique to their gender. And so being able to identify that and being able to effectively treat that and have respect and sensitivity around that.
Thank you for speaking to that, because, you know, working in the substance use disorder field and being a female in recovery myself, I honestly have yet to meet a female who has not had some type of sexual trauma, just for a number of reasons. So thank you for speaking to that. I decided to do this project with people from marginalized communities because I really wanted providers to know more about different communities and to be welcoming and more inclusive, because everybody wants to feel comfortable when asking for help, right? So I want to thank you for being part of this project. And once I decided to do the project, I thought it would be wise to look up what Recovery Month, what the theme for Recovery Month of 2023 was. And it is every person, every family, every community. Can you tell me why that statement is important to you, and or how it speaks to you? Every person, every family, every community.
I mean, in every single way it speaks to me, right? Like, the analogy that we use of someone in the family being addicted is like a grenade going off inside the family.
Mm-hmm.
True. How every single part of every single person is identified and is affected and is hurt. And so likewise in recovery, I mean, my kids were raised in the rooms. I'm privileged to have had that experience, as are they. And so it's been so critical to me that recovery doesn't just mean me, that it means all of us. And it means all of us all of the time. It means to me, whether you're practicing abstinence-based or another kind of program, whether you're in AA or whether you're in another program or whether you're not in any program at all. You know, I try and show up for anyone who might have a desire to quit drinking or drugging exactly as they are. And I would sure want someone to do that for me. As old school as I am today, that's not how I started out, right? Because, you know, and it was so important to me when I was getting sober that people could meet me where I was at, with what I was willing to talk about, what I was not willing to talk about, with just who I was, with who I was not. And so, and for a lot of years, I, while I do have an abstinence-based recovery, that concept was really tricky for me and terrifying for me. And I'm really grateful I had people around me that didn't say, you have to do this. But I did have people around me that said, this is what works for me.
Right.
And I trusted them and believed that. So I think as much as we and the community can give like a wide, like the most expansive grace to anyone who wants to get clean is critical, because we all deserve that and we all need that.
Right.
Everyone, all of the time.
Right. I love that. Thank you. And, you know, just speaking to every family, you know, you made the comment that your girls have grown up in the rooms, which means that they've grown up in the rooms of, for you, Alcoholics Anonymous, which means that they know all about it should they ever encounter it, which was also true for my daughter. And, you know, fast forward, she's in college and somebody, you know, was having problems and she knew what to do and she took them to an open meeting. She doesn't have a problem with alcohol or substances, but she knew where to go and she knew about open meetings and I'll go with you. And so that is important. I want to be mindful of your time. So I want to thank you for agreeing to participate. And you shared a lot of phenomenal information. And so thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate being here. And thank you for your time.
This podcast series is brought to you by the Mid-America Addiction Technology Center, funded by SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. Although funded by SAMHSA, this podcast does not necessarily reflect the views of SAMHSA.